Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We sports fans know great athletes and great coaching make a winning team, but if you listen to the color commentary and the post-game interviews, you'll notice how often the talk turns to the intangibles. Why teams are on a roll or stuck in a losing streak or winning streak, how often teams choke or the one bad play that jinxes a whole season. Teams hire psychologists to get them in a winning frame of mind. This hour on Point, team spirit and the mind games of winners and losers. You can join the conversation. Football, basketball, baseball, hockey, you name it. When does a team hit its stride? When does it choke? What separates the champions from the runners-up? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll hear from Leonard Zajkowski. He's the team psychologist for the Vancouver Canucks. But joining me now from Wimbledon, London, where he's covering the tennis championship, is John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's also co-author of Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. John, thanks for taking your eye off the tennis ball long enough to be with us today.
Ah, oh, pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Good. And joining us from Manhattan Beach, California, is Eric Karros. He's a former Major League Baseball player. For 14 years, he played first base for the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Chicago Cubs, and the Oakland Athletics. He's now a game analyst for Major League Baseball on Fox, and he'll be part of Fox Sports' All-Star Game coverage on July 12th. Welcome, Eric.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. So, guys, we can't talk about teams that choke and teams that don't without talking about the Chicago Cubs, a team that has not won a World Series in more than a century. And I've got right here the standings right now. It doesn't appear the Chicago Cubs are going to win a World Series this year either. Their current record is 32-48. They're 12 games out of first place in second to last place in the National League Central. Eric, as a former Cubs player, the question, is there an emotional or psychological factor that works in determining which teams win and which teams don't? And how important is it, do you think?
Well, I think there's a factor. I think when you're specifically talking about the Cubs, I think there are a number of other variables that are arguably much more important, have much more of an impact on why that organization has struggled over the years. I know when I played there in 2003 and we were five outs away from going to the World Series, that's when a fan leaned over, interfered with a ball. That wasn't why we lost, but I know that people thought, oh, here we go again. It's bad luck, and then the negativity is going to fall out onto the ball club, and we're going to think, oh, we can't win. As a player, I didn't think anything of that. Hmm. I didn't. I just thought, hey, bad play right here. Didn't work out. We're still going to win. It did not change my mental approach the rest of the game, or I still felt like we were going to win. I think it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, it's the mindset. That's why the Cubs don't win in that specific situation. But generally speaking, sure, absolutely. What you believe has some degree of impact. I mean, everybody, I don't know if you can necessarily quantify it and it impacts people differently, but to say that it does have some sort of impact, no question.
John Wertheim, you're a Cubs fan, and you identify yourself as such in your book, Scorecasting, but you also are a bit of a skeptic when it comes to these sort of facile psychological or emotional explanations for why teams like the Cubs don't seem to be able to get it together.
Well, we wrote about the Cubs in our book.
Mike, you wrote a whole chapter about it.
We were a whole chapter. We're both long-suffering Cubs fans, and it was interesting to hear Eric's comments. I mean, we think there's a much more rational explanation for the Cubs' failures. This isn't about billy goats and fans catching balls on the left field line. If you look at the Cubs business model, they draw just about the same fans and sponsorship dollars whether they they win or whether they lose. They have a very quaint ballpark, and fans love to come out to the game and drink beer, and it's a fun day at the park. And the Cubs can lose 100 games, and they'll draw X, and they can win 100 games, and that attendance figure doesn't move much. This year, it's actually started to for the first time. But we surmise that they just don't have the same incentives as other teams. Doesn't mean they're losing on purpose. It doesn't mean there's anything nefarious, but they just don't have the urgency because they don't have those business incentives. I think we compared it to, if you owned a restaurant and you knew the customers were going to come back whether they enjoyed their meal or not, you wouldn't poison them, you wouldn't ruin the meal on purpose, but you wouldn't have that extra motivation to really pull out all the stops. And when you look at some of the personnel moves the Cubs have made or failed to make, and it sort of seeps down. I mean, Joe Girardi, now the Yankees manager, talked about that. He said it just sort of has this culture where there isn't this urgency. And we think the Cubs are unique because it really stems from this very unique business model they have.
Well, Eric, do you think that the business incentives that John is talking about actually affect player performance in terms of motivation?
I'm not so sure that I'd probably say, as a player, former player, the fact that the Cubs play more day games than any other ball club. And remember, the Cubs, up until the mid-40s, maybe the 50s, were arguably the class of the National League. Okay? When night baseball started, that impacts travel, that game time, routine. When you play a game, the facilities in Chicago for the home team are so subpar as far as hitting the batting cages as compared to other facilities. That impacts the home team. Because of the day games, you're not going to get a lot of extra work in during the season at home, where other teams, when you have a night game, you show up at 1 o'clock, you'll go over certain situations, whether it's hitting, ground balls. I don't discount the fact that it may be more profitable to, hey, we're the lovable losers and wait till next year, and there's something to be said about that. And maybe if the Cubs finally do win a World Series, then now what do you sell to the fans each and every year?
Yeah.
I don't discount that at all. But like I said, I would argue till I'm blue in the face the fact that they play the day games and the facilities have much more of an impact on why the Cubs aren't able to win.
Well, let's get away from some of these specifics about the Chicago Cubs and back to kind of the general level. John, you mentioned Joe Girardi, and you quote him in your book, in your chapter on the Chicago Cubs, talking about what it's like to be a Yankee. You quote him as saying, in New York, you go into spring training expecting to get to the World Series. You feel it when you walk in the clubhouse, the pictures of all those Yankee greats, the monuments. There is something special about putting on the pinstripes. So the question is, that's something special. How do you instill that in a team? Did you come to any conclusions on that, John?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of cynics will say, yeah, you're the Yankees and you can spend 3 and 4 times. I mean, Eric can comment on this too, that a lot of cynics would say, yeah, it's easy to win World Series when, you know, there are no limits on your spending and you can spend multiples more than your competition. But no, I mean, sort of every team talks about this culture of winning, and we sort of have this, this sort of aura that seeps through the franchise, and in the case of baseball, it goes all the way to the minor league affiliates, and we have a system and a philosophy. Easier said than done, but it does seem like one reason there is this concentration of titles sometimes is, you know, there are all sorts of reasons, but one of them is, you know, some teams just have this aura and others don't. The Yankees, certainly, the numbers sort of speak for themselves, but again, you will find people, and I don't think it's an invalid point, that'll say, yeah, but it's not a level playing field when you can outspend everyone by factors. Yeah,
right.
Of course you're going to win.
Sure, but let's talk about that aura. I mean, Eric, you've played for a number of different teams. If you discount, you know, day games versus night games, discount payroll, even discount skill and coaching, is there, you know, some other intangible that you have found? Did you feel different? Was there a different culture from one team to the next in your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that if you put on a certain uniform, that whether it's a history that may go with that uniform or that franchise, but I'd argue more importantly, probably the culture created by the individuals at that specific time. The Yankees, you know, for a number of years were not good. I mean, you ask Don Mattingly, and you know, he never went to the playoffs and played for almost a decade there, or he went 1 year, I should say. But the people that were running the organization, the manager, the coaches, they can absolutely create an environment which creates more of a sense of urgency, which I think then will translate into a different style of play. That's why you always see managers, well, he's a player's manager, or he's more of a tactician, or he's a hardline guy. I think organizations look for specific types to try to fit their players, because, again, I do believe that the environment that is created up top in management, in the coach's office, will translate to the players, and that absolutely has an impact on the way you play on the field.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the psychology of the game in team sports. My guests this hour are former Major League first baseman Eric Karros. He played for the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Chicago Cubs, and the Oakland Athletics, and he's now a game analyst for Major League Baseball on Fox. And John Wertheim, he's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and he's the co-author of Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. And John, it's actually a great book. I really enjoyed it. Very well written and very interesting. So congratulations on that. And you were about to make a point. Eric was talking at the end of the last segment about auras that teams have and whether who's responsible, who can sort of build that feeling. And you had a comment you wanted to make.
I just want to throw out real quick that Eric's former team, the Dodgers, obviously filed for bankruptcy a few days ago. And I think one reason this is such a big story is that this was really a class organization. There was a Dodger way and their World Series titles. And, you know, I think the fact, I mean, financially it's a big story, but also to have the culture really undermined by this and have the Dodgers sort of become the sort of laughingstock franchise, I think is really significant. And I think one of the real storylines here is how is this going to affect the players on the field who say, well, we're really divorced from this. This is really a boardroom discussion. But, you know, when the whole franchise has been appended like this, I think invariably, directly or indirectly, there's going to be some effect on the field.
And Eric, do you agree with that?
I would agree that it has some impact. I think, though, that the Dodgers have gone through that, though, or the culture changed really when Fox bought the club from the O'Malleys. The O'Malleys owned the club for so many years. And that was that aura that was created, I say, from the top. There was single-family ownership for, you know, I don't know, 50-some-odd years. And that aura transcended down to the players, to the management. And so there was a certain environment that was created. What's gone on in the last 15 years, and specifically what's gone on here in the last, really, 2 years, you know, where ownership has really become sort of disheveled, that will absolutely impact the organization. I don't think it's not a coincidence, right, that the Dodgers, when the McCourts were separating and the divorce and the issues were created, that was in 2009. The Dodgers, the previous 2 years, were in the National League Championship Series. Since then, the organization has really, really struggled.
Well, we've been talking here about baseball. Let's shift the subject now to hockey and to a series that was recently played, the Stanley Cup Finals this year. In this series, the momentum swung back and forth between the Vancouver Canucks and the Boston Bruins. It was a nail-biting series to the end after the Canucks defeated the Bruins in Game 5. Former NHL player Kevin Weeks and coach Mark Crawford talked about how Canucks goalie Robert Luongo, who had prevented the Bruins from scoring at all, seemed to have the momentum on his side.
After the game, I watched him leave the ice, and he left the ice with authority. It's almost like
right.
he's
with
saying,
purpose.
Hey,
yes.
Not just tonight, people. I'm going to bring it again, because that's what the series has been.
Well, of course, Boston came back and it ended up winning that series, and that raises the whole issue of momentum. But it also raises the issue that we've been talking about up until now, which is, do teams have special cultures, or personalities, or traits. And joining us now from Vancouver, Canada, is Leonard Zajkowski. He's the director of sports science for the Vancouver Canucks. As a sports psychologist, he's also worked with the Boston Celtics and with the Spanish soccer team Real Madrid while they were on their way to the World Cup. Over the years, he's also consulted with the U.S., Canadian, and Australian Olympic organizations, Major League Baseball Players Association, and the NFL and NHL Players Associations, among other organizations. Leonard, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show today.
My pleasure to join you, Tom.
And you are a sports psychologist, so what's your perspective on this idea that we've been talking about, the intangibles that do seem to have some importance in determining how teams do? What can you, as a psychologist, a sports psychologist, do to influence the feeling that exists on a team?
Well, I was very interested in the comments that Eric and John were making. They're so spot on a number of things, and in my role here with the Vancouver Canucks and throughout all the consulting I've done, yeah, I focus on my expertise as a psychologist, but clearly these are mind-body issues. It's the total person. So the approach I'm taking more is trying to integrate science into decision-making. I think the first thing I'd want to mention is that for sure thoughts and emotions on an individual level really impact player actions, how they perform. We can't minimize that for sure. But as I was listening to John and Eric talk about the futility of the Cubs, it reminded me so much of what happened in Boston, where I was for 37 years, and you couldn't avoid being in as part of the discussion on the futility of the Red Sox. And as you all know, it was certainly the emphasis on the curse and a belief in the superstition that the trading of Babe Ruth that created it caused. It was cause-effecting. It caused the futility. And my stance was always, you know, when good management comes in and they get some good players, things will turn around. And that's exactly what happened. And that point was made by both Eric and John, that it's what happens at the top. So, and the same thing will happen for sure with the Cubs when they bring in, you know, good management and good players. They'll be winning, and it's got nothing to do with some kind of curse.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, as long as we're talking about individual teams, I happen to be a Minnesota Vikings fan, and out there in Minnesota, we have this sense that this team over the years has lacked a killer instinct, that they choke when it comes to really big games. Four times the Vikings have been to the Super Bowl, four times they lost. Are there teams that choke, and how do you prepare a team for a really big game when the pressure is really going to be on them?
You know, sometimes we make too big an issue out of this, the word choke. It's a very negative term, and there is the possibility many times, for sure, that people, individual players and a team collectively will underperform in a big game, and we refer to it as choking. But there are other times when, you know, the team is just better than you on a given day. And, you know, we think of, you know, baseball, it's a classic example where it's a one-on-one confrontation between the pitcher and the hitter. And, you know, if the hitter doesn't hit the ball, it's quite possible that he didn't choke. It was just exceptional selection of pitches, and they were right where the hitter could not hit them. So I think many times we overplay this notion of choking. You know, the example you give of the Minnesota Vikings, you know, I was a big Minnesota Viking fan too when Bud Grant was coaching there. That's the many times they went to the Super Bowl and they lost. And so the question does come out, did they underperform, or was the other team much more superior in that particular game? And that's hard to really know.
John, did you, in scorecasting, what conclusion did you come to about this so-called choking phenomenon?
Well, I'm going to be the ogre here and say, you know, if you play sports or watch sports, you feel intuitively we can see this. I mean, you can sort of see teams rise to the challenge. You can see them be burdened and buckle under the weight. But we found that when you look at this sort of statistically, it's very hard to make the case that certain teams, you know, there's a tennis term of treeing, but certain teams, you know, really were in the zone versus certain teams choked. We think we know it when we see it. And anyone that plays sports knows that sometimes the weight of the moment gets to you. But at least when you lay this out statistically, it's very hard to make the case that this doesn't sort of just conform with chance and with luck.
I want to throw out another team here, another example, the Dallas Mavericks. They had a reputation of not being able to win a big game, and this year they had a sports psychologist, Don Cockstein, working with them, and of course this time they did win. I'm curious whether you guys know Don Cockstein and whether in any of your experiences you've found that the addition of a sports psychologist made a difference. Leonard, do you know him?
I just know of him when he was with the Red Sox for many, many years, but he was also with the Mavericks during the years that they weren't winning.
Okay.
You can't, make those kinds of attributions. I believe firmly that lessons are learned by teams when they lose. And that certainly I think the Mavericks did, and Dirk certainly has learned how to perform in these big games. It's a process.
And, Dirk Nowitzki.
Yes. So, I'm sure Cockstein had a bit to do with it, too, but we can't make those kinds of attributions that it was solely because the sports psychologist was there. There's a whole learning process, and a lot of things have to come into play. Injuries are a big part of success and failure many times in team sports as well.
And, Eric, you mentioned earlier that some coaches have the reputation of being players' coaches and seem to have are more able to sort of inspire players. Are there other factors that you think come into play? Have you ever worked with a team psychologist, for example?
Well, we had one with the Los Angeles Dodgers for many years, and you go back to we were talking about the Dallas Mavericks, and I believe that there was a new coach. Carlisle was a coach that hadn't coached there previously. So I don't know. Like I said, there's so many variables that enter into it, and I believe that the mental approach absolutely plays a role. But to say that is specifically what got the Mavericks over the hump or what will inspire a team, I do believe that when you're talking about having a resource like a team psychologist that you can speak with that can get you in a right mental frame of mind, that will absolutely put you in a better position to succeed. Does it guarantee success? Absolutely not. But what it does do is it allows you every affordable opportunity to achieve whatever you're trying to achieve. And what about this? What if you're going against a team that maybe has a better sports psychologist? Then what do you do? I mean, they all play roles, and there's all, like I said, there's so many variables that enter into an individual or a team success.
Well, Leonard's
well said, Eric. That you're spot on there.
And your official title, Leonard, is a director of sports science. So I think that title itself suggests that this is a complicated dynamic. I want to go now to a fan and a caller, Rob, who's calling from Bardstown, Kentucky. Rob, you're on Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to get the panel's thoughts on the Detroit Lions. I'm a big fan of theirs, and we all know they've lost for, forever. And I want to know if what they did last year at the end of the year might be signs that they're turning the corner and what might have been the change in the culture.
Well, let me ask you.
I'll take.
No, no. Before you hang up, Rob, let me ask you what your theory is for why they turned the corner.
Well, for one, I think they left coaching staff in for more than a couple of years, and I think that they got some good players in.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel
other than that? I mean, they came close for a lot of the year, and then the last four games, they start winning the games that they normally lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what the change was there, what got them over the hump.
Leonard Zykowski, what would you have told that team? What would you have done with that team? Are there any exercises that you as a psychologist could use in a situation like that to kind of get a more positive attitude instilled among the players?
Well, it's more than that. For sure, I would do that. But if I could just comment briefly, you know, when you're finishing near the bottom of the pile, you're getting good draft choices. You bring in good management, the kinds of things we talked about earlier. You get a solid organization with a philosophy about winning. Then it's kind of changing that mindset and the culture that they got to believe in themselves. So it's kind of how they think that they believe that they have a real belief that they can win those important games at the end of the season. They're emotionally charged. And that's going to impact on how they perform on the field. But this, you know, it's football is so unique, and there's a lot of players that you have to have coming together to win. It's so darn competitive in the National Football League. So yeah, I would certainly engage in a number of team building exercises, but also emphasizing their belief system that they can win those games, and then being able to teach them to self-regulate their emotions so they're not too high and not too low, but very effective on the playing field.
Eric, in your professional playing career, is there a moment that stands out in your mind when you were on a team that really turned a sharp corner, either from winning to losing or from losing to winning?
I'd go back to the Cubs in the middle of the season. We had just lost a game to the Florida Marlins, and we had a team meeting afterwards where there was a lot of discussion, a lot of yelling, a lot of displeasure. It was ironic because we would later meet the Florida Marlins, who beat us to go to the World Series in the playoffs. But I believe at that point, I think that there was some, whether it was a bonding or a, all right, you know what, we've got half the season to go, let's just throw it all out there. Now, it's not as simple as that, and it never is. But I do believe that was a quote unquote turning point. Just as, you know, maybe when we talked about the futility of the Red Sox, you know, that when they're down 3-0 to the Yankees in the American League Championship Series, and Dave Roberts steals a base. Well, things didn't completely turn on that moment, and that wasn't why they ended up winning the World Series. But it was a huge moment. It was a huge moment. And again, to go back to a specific point, time, or play, I think that can get things going. And in hindsight, you look back and you say, that was it right there. But I there are so many things along the way that, you know, different people would interpret as that was our turning point. That was our moment.
We are the champions. We are the champions. Lose time for losers, 'cause we are the champions.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about team sports and the role of fear and swagger, momentum, all the psychological elements of the game. Last night in Omaha, South Carolina defeated Florida in the College Baseball World Series. South Carolina's second baseman Scott Wingo says his team shined at the right time.
I think our talent might not be a bunch of first-rounders, but I think I'd play with these guys more than any other team. We don't give you one yard.
And back in 1957, Notre Dame's Fighting Irish football team stamped out Oklahoma's 46-game winning streak.
Bob Williams of the Irish stops the Sooner drive with a game-saving interception. Notre Dame ends Oklahoma's 46-game winning streak and hands them their first shutout in 124 consecutive games. In the upset of the year, Terry Brennan's Irish stop Bud Wilkinson's Sooners 7-0.
Winning streaks and losing streaks. My guests are former Major League first baseman Eric Karros for the L.A. Dodgers, Chicago Cubs, and Oakland Athletics, and now a game analyst for Major League Baseball and Fox, John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and Leonard Zajkowski. He is director of sports science for the Vancouver Canucks. John, I want to go to you because you wrote about winning streaks and losing streaks a lot in your book, Scorecasting. You know, again, to use the host prerogative here, I'm also a Minnesota Twins fan. The Twins last night broke a 6-game losing streak, but prior to that, they had won 5 games in a row, and the Twins have the reputation of being what's called a streaky team. John, is there anything really like a streaky team?
Well, in the sense that undeniably they won six, and undeniably they have, you know, lost six before. I mean, there's no question streaks exist and slumps exist and hot streaks, but what we question is whether it's, as you said it before, they're sort of clusters of random events, whether winning X games is really going to predict X plus one. And what we found, I mean, again, you watch sports viscerally, and of course you see that teams come together and the Dallas Mavericks are on the same page and other teams are combusting and we like explanations. But really, when you lay it out, statistically, it's very hard to prove that this is something other than random chance. I mean, even the caller before about the Detroit Lions, you know, if the Lions average 4 or 5 wins per season, even when you're only winning a third of your games, just statistically, you will random chance have 3 or 4 wins in a row. You know, when we, I think in the book we wrote, you know, we flip a coin, it's not heads, tails, heads, tails. You might have 4 heads and 5 tails. Doesn't mean there's momentum or hot streaks in coin flipping.
In fact,
it just means that you have these clusters that aren't alternating. Yes, sir.
You in fact wrote that it's more likely that you're going to have 4 heads in a row or 4 tails in a row than to have a perfectly random sequence.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the player that hits 300, it doesn't mean that, you know, every third at bat he gets a hit. It means over the course of 600 at bats, he'll get 180 hits and he'll have 4 for 4 games and 0 for 4 games. And the team that wins, you know, I was looking at the standings today and you see, oh, the Marlins, for example, have lost, you know, 8 of their last 10 games. Well, they're only winning 40% of their games. So statistically, not so aberration that they'll lose 8 of 10. So I think a lot of times we sort of look for explanations. And we like to attribute things that we get. There was a great pep talk or there was a seminal moment and it really spurred on the team. And it's not necessarily true. On the other hand, you spend time around sports, not only at Eric's level, but just at a, you know, I coach 8-year-old baseball and I could tell that there's confidence and some things are infectious within a team. I mean, some things with the naked eye, you know that something has caused a team to surge, good or bad. But I do think that they're... this sort of misunderstanding about random chance sometimes accounts for a lot of this.
Eric, do you think that Major League baseball players or professional athletes in general understand that and don't get discouraged by losing streaks and perhaps don't get excessively, you know, hopeful in the midst of a winning streak?
Well, I can speak specifically about baseball as far as not getting too enamored with what's going on, whether it's good or bad, just because it's such a long season, as compared to a fan who may rise and fall with every single day. I also believe that, you know, we try to explain everything. Why did this happen? Why did that happen? And, you know, as John just mentioned, it's most of it is just an act of randomness. It happened that day somebody was better than the other. It doesn't mean that, like I said, if you believe you're going to have success, are you in a better spot than going into a competition that you think I have no chance? Absolutely. I'll say that 100 times over. I believe that. But when you're competing against another team or another group, you can't control how they feel or how they, and some days it might be your day, some days it might not be your day, but to try to have an explanation every time of why something happened, drive yourself batty.
Eric, when you're calling a game, do you call attention to, you know, streaks and winning streaks and losing streaks? Do you make a big deal of that in your commentary?
I will acknowledge it, but I don't use that as foreshadowing what, you know, as, well, then this is going to happen because such and such has gone on. I go the other way where I'd say, for instance, if a hitter has a lot of success off of one pitcher, my argument would be he's due to get out. Even though he may have the confidence, just the act of numbers just says that at some point he's going to get out. Even though he may believe that he's going to hit this guy, he's had success, he knows he has success, I think numbers over the course of time probably play a much greater role than somebody's belief that they're going to have success.
Let's go to another former player, a sports fan, Jim, who's calling from McMinnville, Tennessee. Hello, Jim. You're on Point.
Hi, Tom. I played for a high school football coach in Indiana, Don Howe, who was 192-8 in the regular season over 20 years. And we won because we believed we were going to win. And I know that they say all the random numbers and everything, but we knew we were going to win. And you could see it when you watched the game. You could watch the other team would be up by 21 points, and they were scrambling to try to keep us from beating them. And it was just a psychology that lasted. It's affected my whole life.
And
you just said, keep it simple. The team that wants to win the most is the team that's going to win.
And do you credit your coach?
Coach Don Howell, yeah.
And you credit the coach with instilling that attitude.
Yeah, that was his attitude. And our plays were simple. Our game philosophy was simple. And it worked.
Leonard Zajkowski, you've had a long career as a sports psychologist. What's your reaction to, I mean, I'm sure you've heard many stories like this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm hearing this response from Jim. I had many conversations with the late Red Auerbach, and we talked about his early days of coaching with the Celtics. And it was clear to me that he's a well-educated man, and he was just a lot smarter than the coaches in the early days. And I attribute to his early success the fact that he had a huge advantage on other coaches and other systems, other organizations in the NBA. So, I can understand a particular coach at the high school level being just far ahead of the game with other coaches. But that belief system, it does exist. I think the other comments, Eric and John have also commented on that it's the belief is huge. But there's also, John, I really appreciate your comments on, as an old statistics teacher, the importance and the place of randomness and sometimes luck in wins and losses. For sure it's there. But we've all commented that this is a very complicated issue, the success and failure. And yes, belief in your abilities as an individual and as a team are huge, but there are many, many other factors that determine outcomes.
I think, John, you would not say that emotion plays no role in winning and losing. You didn't mean to overemphasize just the randomness of statistics in your book, I don't think, right?
Right. And, you know, even watching a game on TV, obviously we know, Eric keeps is exactly the right term, that they're just infinite variables we're talking about. But you watch a game, you know, anyone that's been to a game knows that emotion plays a role. But emotion's hard to quantify. And I think our point was just that we don't like – it's not even a question of understanding random chance. We don't like it. We like explanations. We like saying, oh, they called a timeout and that was the big play that turned the game and not, stuff happens.
Yeah, and fans for sure want explanations, and that's why, Eric, that's a tough job for you. He's an analyst. They want explanations, and you're right. There's an infinite number of reasons why certain events occur.
Leonard, we played a little bit of the commentary after Game 5 of the Canucks-Bruins series. Give us a little behind the scenes of what it was like going back to Vancouver with two games left in that series, what role you played, and what was the attitude of the team, what were the emotions of the team, and how do you explain what finally happened?
Well, you know, it's my work is typically done during the season, and you try to have them well prepared as the coaches do going into the Stanley Cup playoffs. And I think all of your listeners and the people on the panel here would agree that confidence goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And there are other factors like injuries for sure have played a big role in how we performed in the very end in the seventh game. And it's true also that Boston, if you want to call that momentum, they had a strong belief system that individually and collectively they were very, very good and playing at their very best when it counted. And a belief in, you know, a goaltender getting hot was another big issue. Thomas probably has never played better. He had a great season, but he also played spectacularly in the Stanley Cup Finals. So you can't put a finger on one particular thing that we could say caused the Boston Bruins to beat the Vancouver Canucks.
Right. I have a comment here from Ian Charles. He wrote to our website, onpointradio.org. He wrote, I think it's important to consider the statistic that was done last year about NBA teams. It was found that across the board, the teams that do better and are better, for example, 2008 Celtics, touch each other much more than the teams that do worse. This function of camaraderie just goes to show the teams that are highly dependent on each other, that when teams are highly dependent on each other, a couple of down guys can sink the ship. Eric, camaraderie, did you find that sort of affection and communication between the players on a team makes a big difference?
I'd say that the talent and playing ability would supersede that. I was on a club that lost 99 baseball games in a 162 game season, and we were as close as anybody. So I think that it can play a role, but I would, like I said, I would take talent. I would talk about that Celtic ball club, and while they may have been touching one another all day long, that the talent on that court was as good as anybody. So, like I said, I think that fans always, not always, but want to look at something specific and say, well, this is our explanation for why this happened. And it's just not that simple. You know, as John and Leonard have mentioned, there are so many variables, and they all, how much each variable plays a role in a team's success or an individual's success, it's arguable. But there are so many factors to try and pinpoint just one thing to explain somebody's success. I just think that's difficult to do.
Yeah,
wasn't there one great example of the old Oakland A's who, you know, fought amongst each other all the time, yet won a World Series?
Yeah. I mean, 25 guys, 25 different cabs to the ballpark.
That's right.
So it's. Like I said, that's not to say that teams that have success aren't close, because some are, but it's the talent and the ability to perform in, you know, their specific venue.
Well, there are clearly a lot of factors that explain this. We're trying to sort out which ones are, how important certain ones are versus others. And John Wertheim, you've written a whole book, Scorecasting, about this. Now, I found it interesting when you were writing about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Pittsburgh Pirates. You were pointing out the importance of parity in the NFL that sort of levels teams in terms of payroll, so that they, the team like the Yankees that has huge advantage over others financially can't do that in the NFL. But why have the Steelers in a system of parity, in your judgment, done so well versus other NFL teams that over the years have presumably had the same amount of talent, the same level of coaching, and the same amount of resources to work with?
Yeah, I mean, the NFL in general is fascinating for this. I mean, where else can you have a control group like this where everybody has the same size workforce? You know, it's not like one team has twice as many employees as the other, at least not on the field. It's not as though they're playing extra games. I mean, you have all these controls that really make sports, especially when there's a salary cap, good to look at. We'll see if this holds after the new collective bargaining. But I think, yeah, the Pittsburgh Steelers, Eric was talking about this with the Dodgers. Here you have this franchise that's been owned by one family. It's known as this class organization. There's this history and culture of winning. The Steelers do very well and win Super Bowls disproportionately. And a couple miles up the road, you have the Pittsburgh Pirates that are, you know, two decades now without even having a winning season. How can that be in the same community? But they're, again, going back to the theme of the show, all sorts of variables that make these two franchises just a few miles apart have completely different completely different corporate cultures.
Eric, did you play against the Pittsburgh Pirates at any point?
I did. And that, again, you talk about ownership, you talk about mismanagement, you talk about bad decisions. You know, I think in general what I will say is I've never seen an individual or a team have success without believing or having confidence in their ability. So when we, you know, just trying to cover this whole, the mental state is absolutely important. I've never heard somebody say, well, you know, I think we owe this championship to my negative thoughts and my non-belief in this group. Never. So yeah. I do believe that the mental aspect is huge in all of this.
Eric Karros, thank you so much. And that mental aspect is what we've been talking about here. He's Eric is a former Major League Baseball player for the Dodgers, the Cubs, and the Athletics, now a game analyst for Major League Baseball on Fox. We've also been speaking with John Wertheim. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and co-author of Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind Sports Are Played and Games Are Won. For an excerpt of that book, go to our website, onpointradio.org. And finally, Leonard Zykowski, director of sports science for the Vancouver Canucks. Thank you all, gentlemen. This is On Point.